This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, September 9th, 2009. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda. Coming up in today's program, in Washington, the Supreme Court hears a monumental case that could lead to more corporate money financing election races.
Corporations have lots of knowledge about environment, transportation issues, and you're silencing them during the election.
As the school year begins, New York City restricts the activities of military recruiters. And we take a look at a new film that oil giant Chevron may not want you to see.
The total area in which Texaco polluted is about the size of the state of Rhode Island. We are suing for environmental cleanup.
All these stories and more after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. This afternoon, hijackers boarded an Aeromexico passenger flight in Cancun and touched down in Mexico City. The latest reports say Mexican security forces have gained control of the plane and are holding several people in connection with the plot. The hijackers, who according to initial reports from Mexican media sources are Bolivian, have released the 104 passengers on board and were demanding to speak to Mexican President Felipe Calderon. No more information was available at airtime. At least 28 people have been killed following 2 days of abnormally high rainfall in Istanbul, Turkey. What authorities called the heaviest rain in 80 years flooded low-lying areas of the city. Videos from the ground show chest-deep waters rushing past submerged vehicles and debris everywhere. More rains are forecast later in the week. Despite international pressure to freeze settlement construction in the West Bank, the Israeli government has taken solid steps to follow through on recent and defiant declarations that construction would continue. The government announced today it has chosen the contractor to build nearly 500 new homes in East Jerusalem. FSRN's Ghassan Benoura has more.
The Palestinians and U.S. have demanded the halt of settlement construction in the West Bank and East Jerusalem as a condition for the peace process to move forward. But last week, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said a large number of settlements already in progress would continue. The government says the call for construction bids for this settlement was first published last year, but the terms of the bids were rejected. Following appeals by the construction companies last month, Israel decided to reverse the decision. The announcement comes as U.S. envoy George Mitchell is slated to travel to the region late this week. Many European countries are increasing pressure on Israel by divesting economically. Ghassan Barnoura, FSRN, Bethlehem.
25,000 farmers in the northern Indian state of Punjab marched through the streets of the regional capital Chandigarh today to protest the privatization of the Punjab State Electricity Board. One protester was killed when he was run over by a car, and at least 65 were injured. Farmers threw stones and torched several vehicles. Police used tear gas and batons to subdue the protesters. Audio from India's Star News. The Punjab farmers are concerned the privatization of the electricity supply will mean the end of free power for farmers in the region. Workers at the Metrovia subway in Buenos Aires are set to go on strike tomorrow over recognition of an independent union. FSRN's Marie Trigona reports from Argentina.
Subway passengers rode free of charge this morning in Buenos Aires as part of a transit workers' protest action. The workers want the labor ministry to legally recognize their grassroots union they say will protect workers' interests. Subway employees met resistance from police and representatives from the UTA, the Transport Workers Union, which is allied with the Metrovias Transit Corporation and has controlled the Subway Workers Union since the 1970s. 70% of Metrovias employees voted to form a new, independent union organization in an election earlier this year. This morning, in the midst of a scuffle between transit security and independent union delegates at ticket counters, Nestor Segovia, a rank-and-file worker, said that the government has refused to follow laws protecting democratic union representation.
Workers from our hearts, we are fighting for freedom for workers. We can't allow monopolistic companies to have all the authority. We cannot allow the company to fire three workers.
The three workers Segovia referred to had work-related health problems and were fired by Metro Vias. Independent union representatives will go on strike tomorrow, paralyzing the city's subway transport to pressure the labor ministry and to demand that the company rehire the three workers. Marie Trigona, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
After 32 years, the families of a team of British and Australian journalists may find out how the relatives died while filming the start of Indonesia's bloody invasion of East Timor. The Australian Federal Police announced today they have launched a war crimes investigation after a coroner ruled the deaths were intentional. Naomi Fowler reports.
The families of the five journalists have always alleged the Australian and Indonesian governments were involved in a cover-up of the murders. For years, the Indonesian military claimed the men were killed in the crossfire between their troops and East Timorese freedom fighters, despite eyewitness testimony to the contrary. The bodies were found shot, stabbed and burned. If the Australian Federal Police finds the men's deaths were a war crime, Indonesian army officers could be tried in an Australian court. But the families believe there are still too many vested interests at play for that to happen. A recent film about the journalists has refocused attention on the British and Australian diplomats who tacitly encouraged Indonesia's invasion and allegedly have tried to avoid embarrassing its government with questions about the killings. Naomi Fowler, FSRN, London.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
The Supreme Court came out of its recess to hear a case that could loosen limitations on corporations' ability to spend money on political campaigns. As FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports, the Supreme Court is on the verge of allowing a flood of corporate money to influence elections.
Associate Justice Sonia Sotomayor heard her first case before the Supreme Court. And the High Court's decision in this case could dramatically change national elections. If it overturns previous decisions and Congress, corporations would no longer be prohibited from spending money during political campaigns. The case came about because Citizens United, a conservative nonprofit, made a critical documentary on Hillary Clinton. Hillary the Movie was to be released to coincide with the 2008 elections and be available on cable's video on demand. Citizens United was challenged. Opponents said it violated campaign finance laws because of the timing of the release, because of the venue where it would be broadcast, and because a nonprofit corporation was using it to influence the elections. The court heard the case in March, but then decided that a larger issue needed to be addressed. That issue is if corporations can spend money on politics during an election. The legal question at hand is, should a corporation have the same rights as an individual's freedom of speech during elections? Theodore Olson argued on behalf of Citizens United. He says that corporations should have the same First Amendment rights as an individual.
My point is that the government here has an overbroad statute that covers every corporation, irrespective of what its stockholders think, irrespective of whether it's big, whether it's general, a big railroad baron or anything like that.
A corporation can spend money on elections if they collect money from individuals and funnel it to a special account called a PAC or a political action committee. The outcome of this case could allow corporations to use money from its general treasury, profits obtained from consumers, to influence an election. The court has long limited the rights of a corporation to express itself during the campaign season, especially in two cases, one in 1990 and a more recent one in 2003. But the conservative justices appeared to side with the appellant, Citizens United, including Justice Kennedy, who is often the crucial swing vote.
The government silences a corporate objector, and those corporations may have the most knowledge of this on the subject. Corporations have lots of knowledge about environment, transportation issues, and you're silencing them during the election.
Solicitor General Elena Kagan argued on behalf of the government. She responded to Justice Kennedy.
To the extent, Justice Kennedy, that you're talking about what goes on in the halls of Congress, of course, corporations can lobby members of Congress in the same way that they could before this legislation. What this legislation is designed to do, because of this anti-corruption interest, is to make sure that that lobbying is just persuasion and it's not coercion.
But Chief Justice John Roberts said corporations should be able to oppose a candidate that does not support their interest.
Take a tobacco company, and a candidate's running on the platform that they ought to make tobacco illegal. Presumably that company would maximize its shareholders' interests by opposing the election of that individual.
Elena Kagan said a corporation has one goal in mind, personal profits.
But everything is geared through the corporation's self-interest in order to maximize profits, in order to maximize revenue, in order to maximize value. Individuals are more complicated than that. So that when corporations engage the political process, they do it with that set of, you know, blinders.
This is the third time the court will hear a challenge to the 2002 McCain-Feingold legislation, which curbed money in politics. The legislation authors, Senator John McCain and Russ Feingold, sat in on the 90-minute long arguments. Senator McCain was disappointed in the proceedings, which seemed to side with the corporations.
Well, my takeaway from some of the questions is extreme naivete about the influence of money, corporate and union, and soft money on the legislative process.
The court could rule before Christmas. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
President Obama will give a speech to Congress tonight laying out his vision for health care reform. The president will try to swing congressional votes and public opinion his way during the speech, which some experts see as a critical moment in his first year in office. FSRN's Matt Pearson reports.
During congressional recess, many lawmakers took heat in their districts over health care reform. Now that they're back, the pressure is still on. On Capitol Hill today, groups of protesters stood outside of congressional office buildings, picketing for and against health care reform. Inside the chambers, lawmakers readied themselves for the fight ahead. The president will make a speech Wednesday night that states his goal of passing health care legislation this fall. Experts say the president will lay out a plan for reform that he thinks will attract enough votes to pass a bill this year. But Republicans in Congress continue to be highly critical of Democratic plans. Speaking at a press conference in the Senate, Republican leader John Boehner had a message for the president.
I hope he's been listening to the American people, because I think over the course of August, they've raised their voices loud and clear that they don't want this massive government takeover of our health care system. But it appears that the president's going to double down tonight and try to put lipstick on this pig and call it something else.
Tonight, aides say, the president will clearly state his priorities for health care reform. Igor Volsky, healthcare researcher and blogger at the Center for American Progress, says the president needs to win back control over the healthcare debate after well-organized protesters have threatened his message.
He is speaking to the American public, who he needs to remind that healthcare reform is about changing the way insurers do business so that they stop rescinding coverage, denying coverage because of pre-existing conditions, and start working for the American people. He needs to remind Americans that the only rationing of care is doing nothing. That if we fail to act in 20, 30 years, millions of middle-class families will be in bankruptcy.
Volsky says the president also has work to do in winning over key moderates in the Senate. While a health bill, including a public option, will likely pass in the House, a path for reform is less clear in the Senate. Volsky says the speech tonight will be only the first step in convincing key senators to support his bill.
The president has invested a lot of political capital in trying to kind of shape the debate from 3,000 feet. Now is his time to really engage with Congress on a personal level. He has to make those phone calls to the senators who he thinks are key in this debate, Olympia Snowe, Susan Collins, Ben Nelson, those senators who he thinks he can still win over. He needs to call them 10, 12, 13 times to secure their vote.
Republican leadership has signaled they won't support any form of comprehensive health care legislation. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says the big government approach won't work.
I personally think a better way to go at it is to do some of these bills individually and target the problems. What we don't think is appropriate is taking one of these 1,000-plus-page omnibus-type approaches to this bill.
It's not only Republicans who pose an obstacle for the president. Many Democrats in the Senate have been reluctant to throw their support behind some provisions, including the public option. Volsky says he doesn't expect the president to draw a line in the sand on that issue tonight.
My sense is he's going to say that the public option is critical to controlling health care costs, but he's not going to go so far as to say that he would veto a bill without a public option, so he's not going to strongly insist on it.
The president's address begins at 8 p.m. Eastern tonight. Matt Pearson, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Students return to school in New York City today, and this year they may be seeing less of military recruiters. New regulations went into effect today that restrict the military's access to students' personal information and require schools to monitor recruiter activity. But some say the new policies don't go far enough. Jaisal Noor with the Community News Production Institute has more.
When New York City 12th grader Sierra Boyd recently talked a friend out of joining the military, she got something she wasn't expecting, an irate call from her friend's recruiter.
And he's yelling at me on the phone, like, you need to mind your business. I don't understand why you're telling him not to enlist. He's a man. He can make his own decision. You lucky I don't know where you live. Like, he was very upset on the phone.
Incidents like this one have fueled government inquiries, media investigations, and campaigns to limit the military's access to students. For the last 6 years, the group Students Not Soldiers Coalition has lobbied New York City Schools Chancellor Joe Klein to adopt formal rules for military recruitment in public schools. This decision could have national ramifications because New York City is the country's largest school district. Additionally, schools must make available the forms to opt out of the No Child Left Behind provision that automatically releases students' contact information to recruiters. And for the first time, 9th and 10th graders can also opt out on their own. Every school must also create and publicize a grievance procedure to report recruiter misconduct that will be included in the opt-out letter. The rules also mandate that if a school administers the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery Test, the school must keep students' information private. Amy Wagner heads the YaYa Network, a student organizing group. She says the rules may have serious shortcomings.
It requires each school to appoint a point person. Who will that person be? Who will train them? Who will make sure they have accurate information? That each school needs to create a plan. Well, who's going to review the plans?
Activists are also concerned that the new policies fail to recognize a serious problem. Recruiters disproportionately target poor and minority students.
All you need to do is look at a map of where the recruiting stations are in New York. They're in low-income communities, and they're close to community colleges with low-income populations, and the schools that we hear about them being in the most are schools with low-income students of color.
The new regulations do not protect students' information from other Pentagon databases, such as the Joint Advertising Market Research Studies database, which contains information on 34 million young people. According to the Pentagon, the only way to opt out of having the information in the database released to recruiters is for parents to send a letter to the Pentagon. When FSRN contacted New York City's military recruiter spokesperson to comment on the new rules, she said she was not aware they existed. Jaisal Noor, FSRN, New York.
In West Virginia, environmental activists continue their protest of Massey Energy and the company's use of mountaintop removal mining. At 5 a.m. Eastern Time, four activists locked themselves together between a guardrail and a tree to prevent people from entering the company's regional offices in Madison, West Virginia. 81-year-old Ronald Micklem came from upstate New York to join the campaign.
We're at the driveway to Massey Regional Headquarters. And we're making our witness and our stand here. We're here to stop the egregious environmental practice of mountaintop removal. It is by far the worst environmental crime of the century. An area of the landmass of Delaware throughout the Appalachians has been devastated by mountaintop removal. And as far as I'm concerned, it is destroying God's creation, which I think is a sin.
Police arrested Micklem and three other activists. an independent journalist at the scene, was also arrested. Climate Ground Zero organized today's protest, as well as a recent week-long tree sit. Spokesperson Andrew Munn says this is the group's 14th nonviolent action to protest mountaintop removal mining.
Every action we've seen, we've gained both more allies on the local level and more allies on the national level. Most notably, at the end of the tree sit, two security guards that were hired by a security company contracted by Massey to guard the site of the tree sit came out and voiced both their support for the tree sit and their opposition to mountaintop removal and Massey Energy. So absolutely, and we believe that we are gaining more ground. This is a campaign of nonviolent civil disobedience, and as such, it is, I suppose, more confrontational than a lot of the tactics that are used by other environmental groups. But it's very clear that public opinion is on our side. So we believe that this is an issue that needs to be made more of, and that's what we're doing.
The activists arrested today were charged with trespass, conspiracy, destruction of property, disobeying a lawful order, and resisting arrest. The journalist, Johnny Lapis, was charged with trespass, failure to obey a lawful command, and conspiracy, according to Climate Ground Zero. The organization says these are trumped-up charges, as the activists all pledged not to engage in property destruction. During mountaintop removal mining, mining companies use explosives to blow off the tops of mountains to get to coal reserves. Environmentalists oppose the damage to mountains, saying it transforms diverse ecosystems into barren moonscapes. The practice also has other impacts, including the dumping of millions of tons of debris from the blown-off mountaintops to valleys and streams below. According to the regional group Mountain Justice, coal companies have buried more than 1,200 miles of Appalachian headwater streams through mountaintop removal mining. You're listening to FSRN. New documentary by award-winning filmmaker Joe Berlinger opens in New York today. Here's part of the trailer.
What was once paradise now has just been left in destruction.
The total area which Texaco polluted is about the size of the state of Rhode Island. We are suing for environmental cleanup.
The plaintiff's accusation is defamatory and not true. It's just false and wrong.
The documentary is called Crude, and it tells the story of how Texaco polluted Ecuador's rainforest as it extracted oil from an area the size of Rhode Island. Texaco was bought by Chevron earlier this decade. Indigenous groups are suing the oil giant for the damage caused during more than 20 years of oil drilling. They claim Texaco spilled millions of gallons of crude oil into the rainforest soil and released more than 18 billion gallons of wastewater into rivers and streams. The indigenous people of the area say they suffer from high cancer rates and birth defects as a result, and they're suing for compensation in an Ecuadorian court. Damages could be worth up to $27 billion. One of the organizations appearing in this film is Amazon Watch, an advocacy group that exposes corporate abuse in rainforests in several countries. We're on the line now with Mitch Anderson. He's the lead campaigner for Amazon Watch's Ecuador project, and he's helping to promote this latest film. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the program.
Mitch, Director Joe Berlinger says he was trying to avoid making an environmental disaster exposé. He said he wanted to look at the broader picture and to analyze how hard it is to achieve justice in the real world. What are your views on the final product after seeing the film?
Well, I think that Director Joe Berlinger and his associate Mike Bonfiglio really hit sort of the nervous center on this one. They saw the story as something bigger than an environmental exposé. They saw it as a story of power. We have one of the biggest oil corporations in the world, Chevron, which created massive environmental disaster in the Ecuadorian Amazon, and we have 30,000 indigenous and campesino peoples fighting this historic legal battle. What you have in Crude is essentially a story that allows both sides, both Chevron and the indigenous people of the Ecuadorian Amazon and their legal team, to air their views on what is happening in this case.
Now, there's some very interesting characters in this film, like an American lawyer who's helping the Ecuadorian communities to pursue this case, and a local lawyer who used to be an oil worker. Could you tell us a bit more about these folks and the struggles they're leading?
Well, Pablo Fajardo is the Ecuadorian attorney on this case, and he really has just an amazing story. He used to work for the oil companies in the fields. He saw all of the devastation. He felt it with his own heart, and he became a lawyer, and this is the first case that he has taken on, and it turns out to be one of the biggest environmental litigations in history. He's really sort of brought the people in Ecuador together, gave hope, and he has this sort of moral rectitude that is really contagious in Ecuador.
Your organization has visited the area polluted by the oil drilling, by Texaco's and Chevron's oil drilling. What's the situation like for the people who live in that part of the Amazon rainforest?
This is a massive public health crisis that is affecting thousands and thousands of people, both indigenous and campesinos alike. I mean, this is a story of a company that went into the Ecuadorian Amazon, deliberately dumped billions and billions of gallons of toxic wastewater, spilled roughly 17 million gallons of crude oil, turned a whopping profit, and then decided to leave in the early 90s.
Right, so Chevron says that while they were drilling in the area, they were complying with the environmental standards of the time. What case are the plaintiffs making here in this lawsuit?
Texaco, in the United States at the time, was reinjecting the toxic wastewaters back into the earth instead of simply dumping them into the rivers and streams of the United States. In Ecuador at the time, however, Texaco decided to save several dollars a barrel of oil, and instead of reinjecting the toxic byproducts of drilling, they decided to deliberately dump those byproducts into the rivers, into the streams of the Ecuadorian rainforest.
Now, Chevron is concerned that these legal proceedings have been influenced by local politics because it's a new government now, a left-wing government. And so, you know, this government is saying different things about the remediation process that was okay with previous Ecuadorian governments. What do you think about that argument?
This case has been going on for 16 years. For the first 9 years of the case, it was heard actually in New York, and Chevron argued for 9 years that they wanted the case to be transferred to Ecuador because that was the fair jurisdiction. That was where it should be heard. Now that it's in Ecuador, now that there's a $27 billion damages claim and we're on the verge of a decision, Chevron is pulling out all sorts of dirty tactics, dirty tricks to try to derail this process. You know, one of them is to cry, you know, foul play and say the Ecuadorian government is involved.
That was Mitch Anderson from Amazon Watch. His organization's promoting a new documentary on Ecuadorian communities who are suing oil giant Chevron over the pollution of a massive part of the Amazon rainforest. Documentary is called Crude, and it will make its New York debut today. You can check out the trailer on our website, www.fsrn.org. And that's all for today's program. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. We podcast our newscast at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. Today's newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Our headlines editor was Jess Burns. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda.